Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Assuming you're at home or at work right now, look around you. How tidy or untidy is your personal space? What pictures and knickknacks and items are within easy view? What gadgets are within reach? And what is stuffed away out of sight in your drawers or closets? If you were to get up and leave and let a stranger come in and inspect what is visible in your home or office, what image would that person create of you? An average person might get some things right and make other assumptions that were completely off base. But with the right research information and training, my guest today argues a person could likely deduce everything from your relative openness to new ideas, to how cooperative you tend to be in a group setting, to how neurotic you are, or are not. And while you might clean up to impress clients or company, faking it in your personal spaces to convey a different personality is a lot harder to pull off than you might think. Sam Gosling is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. He writes about his research in a new book called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Sam, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot.
This concept struck me at the very beginning as something, the book struck me as something that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would have really loved to read. This is like Sherlock Holmes stuff.
It is like Sherlock Holmes stuff. And, you know, to a certain extent, all we're doing really is observations. What distinguishes what my approach does from say, Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or whoever it is trying to think about, is starting from the assumptions about how we connect to our spaces around us, like from a psychological perspective. What is it that connects us to our spaces? Why do we have the spaces we do? Why do we choose the spaces we do? And then using that knowledge combined with Sherlock Holmes skills to figure out what we think about others and they think about us.
And you discovered that it's not just psychologists and detectives, but people like architects and mechanics are making these assumptions all the time.
Yeah, we're all doing it. I mean, if you think about who for the last 10,000 years or more, 100,000 years, have provided us with the most opportunities and threats, it's other human beings. So we humans are very attuned to looking for any information we can about what people are like. We look everywhere we can. And so I think we're always looking around. And it's only when we get a surprise that we realize we're doing it. If you've been hanging out with somebody, you're getting to know them, and the first time you go back to the house, then you suddenly see a large collection of moose heads or something like that on the wall. And then you're surprised. Think, whoa, wait a minute. The very fact that you're surprised shows that you're doing it all the time ordinarily. It's just it normally doesn't reach consciousness.
So there are essentially five basic personality traits that you have used to link to this research in a really scientific way. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so there are two ways to think about personality. One is how deep we go, but whether we talk about traits or values or identity. But if we're talking about personality traits, so by personality traits, I mean these sort of regularities in behavior. Then the most widely accepted scientific model now is known as the Big Five framework, the five-factor model. And that suggests that most of our behavioral regularities can be summarized in terms of these five broad dimensions. The first one is what they call extroversion. This is, as you'd expect, people who are outgoing and who get excited by the thought of a party. They don't get anxious at the thought of a party. They're energetic. They tend to be more dominant and so on. I call this the Eddie Murphy factor because, you know, he always plays these very extroverted characters, the Beverly Hills Cop, for example. And then the next factor is agreeableness. It's people who are sympathetic, kind, warm versus people who are more harsh, they're more critical, they're less sentimental. So I call this is sort of the Mr. Rogers factor. The next one is what I call the Robocop factor, or really the air traffic control factor, which is conscientiousness. So this is people who are task-oriented, they're task-focused, they think before they act, they're not impulsive. It's the people you want sitting in the air traffic control towers. They arrive at work at time, they pay attention to what's going on, they pay attention to the planes coming in, the planes going out. They have spare stamps in their wallet, they have their pencils are sharp, they think before they act. Then the next one's is the Woody Allen factor, it's the neuroticism, or anxious. It's people who are anxious versus people who are calm and laid back. And then the final one, openness, is what I call the Leonardo factor, people who like to play with ideas. They prefer the new, they're curious, they're intellectual. They value the abstract and thinking rather than people on the other end of the scale who are more traditional. They value the known, the concrete. And so, you know, if you think about how these might be different, the person who is high on this trait, they go to a restaurant and they look at the menu and they say, I've never seen that item before, I'll have that one. Whereas people at the other end of the trait say, I like the spaghetti, I know what I like what I know, give me the spaghetti.
So when people are decorating, certainly at home or even putting things up in the office, they're probably not thinking, I want to show the world that I'm extroverted or open to new ideas. And yet they do all these things, or neurotic for that matter. And yet we do this without really realizing what's going on. Can you talk about some of the items that you look at first when you're trying to determine these traits?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think when much of what we do is meeting psychological functions, various psychological functions, when we're putting something up, we're not thinking, how can I make myself feel better? How can I have a social snack to remind me of my family? How can I make a statement to others? We're just thinking, hey, I like that. That feels nice. It's just what comes naturally to us, which is why it's these unconscious processes that I think one of the most interesting things about this research is it begins to make us think about these things we do automatically. So I think one of the things, I think part of what we do with our spaces is what you say, is we are making claims to others. These are what I call identity claims. We do deliberately put things up in our spaces. We put up a poster, and that is making a deliberate statement to others and also to a certain extent to ourselves about our values and our goals and how we like to be regarded. But just because it's deliberate, that doesn't mean that it's disingenuous. I think much of these statements we make to others are actually about getting to people to see us as we really see ourselves. And a lot of psychological research has shown that, is that people really want to be known. So I think there is a certain amount of deliberately telling other people. But then I think many of the other things are not to do with deliberately telling other people things. So we do craft our environments to make ourselves feel a certain way. So if you want to get... if you want to focus and concentrate, you go to a quiet library, you don't go to a nightclub, or you play music to make yourself feel a certain way, or you decorate. Some people have bathrooms that are relaxing and calm, and they have fragrant candles and stuff to put in the bath and low lighting, whereas others have exciting, stimulating places. So we change the environments to affect how we feel. This is what I call feeling regulators. And then the third category of how we... of how we express ourselves in our spaces is inadvertently doing with what I call behavioral residue. That's my desk, for example, is complete chaos. But it's not chaos because I'm trying to tell people I'm chaotic or I'm doing it. It's there just because I get something out and I just don't put it back. I get distracted and just put it down. And then you end up with these huge layers of sediment going back many, many months and years. So I think, you know, some of the things we put out, we do tell people, but not all of them.
So how do you keep your own personal personality traits and your own personal intuitions out of the formula when you're trying to look at someone else? Because your desk may strike you as chaotic.
Yeah.
To someone else, it may not look so bad at all. And to a third person, they might wonder how you could even work there.
Right, exactly. So and that's why there's many different important things to do when you are beginning to snoop around. And one of them, you're right, is to get a broad idea of the sort of the general standards of a place. I was asked to go recently into a journalist's Newsweek offices and look around there. And I went, but before looking at any of the offices that I was there to assess, it was very important to look around many others first, because you have to judge the standards for that place, because they vary from organization to organization. Some places tend to be messier. Some places don't allow you to put things on the wall. One advertising agency we went around, that everybody had stuff on the wall. So the standards vary from place to place and from person to person. I've had people come into my office, some of whom can't imagine how you could get anything done. Others think it's scarily organized. So yeah, you're right. People have very different standards, and that, of course, is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to fake a space, because our standards are so different. It's very difficult to fake that difference in perception across people.
Now, is this phenomenon something that's limited to places like the United States, where we have sufficient capital and resources and things to make real decisions about what we have around us?
I think to a certain extent, you need to have a certain degree of financial viability in order to make some of these choices, but many of them don't require a great amount of money in order to make these statements. So I think what we would see, although I haven't done studies in other countries, I think what we would see is these same processes going on. We'd still see people making statement about themselves to others and making them feel a certain way by crafting the space and having these behavioral residues. But I think the specific items that these processes reflect would vary from culture to culture.
You dropped this term a few minutes ago that I really like, social snack. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, social snacks are really interesting. So social snacks are really a part of feeling regulators, and that's the idea that, and it is very literally borrowing from the eating metaphor, is that when we are away from our loved ones or a place that's important to us or a pet that's important to us, we often want to have a little dose of that individual. And so what we do often is we carry around that, and that's why we have photos in our wallets, and sometimes we have photos on our desks, and that, so it allows us to just flick our eyes right across the computer monitor to have a look at these photos, and it's just a little dose of that person. One of my colleagues here, he has his social snack on the inside of a cabinet in his office, and I only noticed him looking at it once, and that's how I knew it was there. And it was a very admired colleague and mentor of his. But having him there out the time would be almost too much, too overwhelming. So what he does is he has the pictures of this colleague, his name's Ned, taped to the inside of a cupboard so he can just open it up and take little doses as needed.
My guest is Sam Govesling. He's an associate professor of psychology at UT. His new book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. So many times we can look at someone's space or someone's home and think we've got them all figured out, but it's pretty easy, you say, to be led astray by kind of a red herring.
Yeah, there's many easy mistakes to make, and you're right. When you go into somebody's space, you form impressions, and it turns out our research shows that some of those impressions are right. So some of them are correct. But many of the impressions that we're forming are incorrect, too. And so really, you need to know what the research shows to know which of these assumptions are right and which are wrong. One of the biggest mistakes people make is in looking at very distinctive objects. So one of the techniques we use when we're snooping is we're looking for patterns, for continuities across the space. So, and the things that stick out are things that are inconsistent with the continuities. That's why they stick out. And so our attention is drawn to them. But the very reason that our attention is drawn to them, because they stick out, is the reason that they probably are misleading. That is, if I had a religious CD music sitting on my desk, it would stick out because the other things are very inconsistent with that in my desk. So people's attention would be drawn to it, but it would be misleading. When you're going in, we're really looking for patterns, and these things that stick out, you have to be very careful about.
Have you been surprised by how willing people are, in fact, excited for you to go in and look at their things when they're not there?
Yeah, surprised by that. And it's really been, so people have this feeling of ambivalence. The first thing they think is, no, I don't want anybody coming in my space. I don't want anyone doing that. And then as the idea begins to percolate through their minds, they actually want to know, well, how am I viewed? It's kind of interesting to know, what do people think of you on the basis of your space? And indeed, in our first study, I had initial difficulties getting people to sign up for it. But then very soon afterward, towards the end of the study, I had people begging to be included.
Sam Govesling is my guest. He's an associate professor of psychology at UT. His new book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll talk about how architects are using this new research to craft people's homes.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sam Gosling. He's an associate professor of psychology at UT. His new book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. A lot of people, Sam, feel like they're using different elements of their personalities, depending on whether they're at home or they're at work. How close are the ways people set up their offices as compared with their homes?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that generally they're the same. I mean, there are some differences, and of course, that makes sense. After all, our behaviors do vary slightly from our home life to our work life. It's quite possible that some of us are much more organized and on the ball in one place, or more able to think about broader interests and so on in another. And we would expect those differences in how we behave, slight differences in personality almost, to be reflected in those spaces. But I think it's important to also bear in mind that some of those differences, I think, we believe are bigger than they are, because we tend to notice differences in ourselves. We tend to notice the difference between our workspace and our home space. And I think we tend to exaggerate that difference and think it's bigger than, in fact, say, the difference between me at my workspace and somebody else at their workspace. So we think the difference between me and my workspace and me and my home space is big, but it's not actually as big as the difference between me and another coworker.
Well, a lot of people, if they're fortunate enough to have their own office or even their own cubicle, can sort of set it up. But many people live at home with other people. How does that cause a lot of conflicts? People, one person being very introverted and another person being extroverted and sharing the same room.
Yeah, I think when people live together, it does make it difficult. Lots of negotiation essentially goes on in the space, in terms of what goes up and what doesn't, or really the things that can be very difficult is when people have different needs in terms of what's neat and what's tidy, and that can cause a lot of conflict. And when we're looking around spaces owned by multiple people, you can often see that. What often happens, though, is that someone, and this is important for when you're looking around at somebody's space, is that somebody has their own little area, even if the public area is either negotiated or one person has control of it. Some of us have our own space, whether it's the garage or an office or a kitchen area. We tend to have at least a little refuge where we can go and be ourselves.
Do women, you mentioned the garage, and I know a lot of guys who call that their man cave. You know, that's their space that their wife or their girlfriend lets them have.
Yeah.
Do women tend to control personal spaces at home more than men?
Well, they will tend to control, in terms of the public space that they do. The women, for many traditional reasons, women have long been associated with the people responsible for that. So you tend to get, they also tend to be more concerned and focused with social interactions and the places in which those interactions take place. So, yeah.
You profile in the book the work of a really interesting architect called Chris Travis, and he basically, without doing so purposely at first, really works a lot of this kind of thinking into his approach to designing homes for people.
Yeah, I think Chris Travis is a very, very interesting person. He really noticed that what goes on when a client goes to an architect it often results in what's essentially a dysfunctional relationship. It's intrinsically dysfunctional in the sense that the way architects have traditionally been trained and traditionally worked is in the tradition of being an artist. So we are an artist, and I, as the architect, will give you my creation, and you, the client, are very lucky to live in it and enjoy it. Whereas the clients aren't thinking about that. They think we want this place that makes us feel good and just feels like home. And it's very inappropriate. You don't tell an artist, well, I think you should have a little bit more orange on your painting. And architects, although they may sort of nod their head to taking into account their client's needs, that's typically not the way it goes. They may say that they'll do that, but that's not where they start. They say, okay, here's my building, this is what I do, but it's not really starting from the basic psychological needs of the client. And that's where Chris Travis comes in. Chris Travis, before he's done anything, engages in very, very extensive interviews, psychological interviews, sometimes even involving a therapist, to really get at the underlying psychological needs of the clients, many of which we're unaware of. So I think many clients come to Chris Travis and say, hey, we want some, you know, an Italian, you know, 16th century style building. Well, really, that's not what they want. And so he goes through these processes, these exercises, which are often very playful in nature, because that sort of makes people less defensive about what they need. These very playful exercises, which help them get at their associations with physical spaces, which he then can begin to integrate into his designs.
To what extent, Sam, do you think the places that we live and work and exist shape our personalities?
I think they do shape them to a certain extent, and that's one of the reasons why we create them. I mean, we create spaces to allow us to feel a certain way and to allow us to express certain attitudes and ideas and so on. And I think that that's much of actually what's going on in a space. Sometimes recreating a feeling. In fact, you know, Chris Travis, in his work, he's noticed that time and time again, people are trying to recreate a space from a time when they were happy. Often, it turns out, at a grandparent's home. So they'll look back at these happy moments of when they went with, say, their parents to a grandparent's home, and these moments represented moments of happiness and relaxation and joy. And without realizing it, people are often trying to recreate that a little bit when they're renovating or building their own place later in life.
So it's a matter of figuring out what you want and how it's going to work for you.
Yeah, but it's something that it's hard to know, because we don't really aren't really aware of these processes at all. And in fact, Chris Travis finds his clients are quite resistant to even afterwards acknowledging that these processes have anything to do with their building. I interviewed a whole bunch of his clients, actually, and they would tell me, we have this wonderful place, it fits us beautifully, it's just what we want, we wouldn't change a thing. And I say, okay, so could you tell me a little bit about how the process you went through with Travis beforehand helped you arrive at this building? And they say, oh, it didn't have anything to do with that, it was completely coincidental. So even afterwards, people are very resistant to acknowledging that these sort of underlying psychological forces are at work, because Chris Travis believes it, because it makes them feel loss of control.
So to what extent is this sort of a temporal kind of research? I was thinking about, for example, I know that you've worked with a lot of college students. And
yeah.
When I was in school, I had a great taste for kitsch, and I liked a lot of junk everywhere. And I don't like any of that now. And,
yeah.
And I always thought my taste had just evolved, but I think maybe I'm a different person.
Well, we are changing. That's certainly true, and I think it's in some sense hard to discriminate between you saying your tastes have evolved and you're being a different person, because, you know, in a sense that's what makes you a different person.
Sure.
Because your tastes have evolved. So I think, you know, both of those things are true, and indeed they do reflect things that are enduring in a smaller sense, you know, week to week, month to month, but doesn't mean that's what you'll be like in 20 years' time.
Is there a really good psychological theory as to why humans need to decorate at all?
Well, I think one of the reasons, as I've talked about, is this need to be known. We know that when people are known, they are happier, healthier, and more productive. So I think in many of our social interactions too, research over the past 10 to 20 years have shown is what we're doing is trying to get people to see us as we see ourselves. So I think that's one of the main reasons why we do this. We're also, of course, just creating a space to make us feel good.
So we've talked a lot about physical space, but these days you can't ignore the questions of virtual space, the
yeah.
ways and the places that we exist online.
Mm-hmm.
How different is it there?
Well, we've looked at those, because it's absolutely fascinating. If you think about MySpace and Facebook and these other social networking sites, and you think of how many, you know, tens of millions of people are on these, and they spend hours, especially younger people, spend hours and hours on these sites. And so it's really quite curious, because if you look at them from the outside, it all looks pretty frivolous. And the question is, why are people doing this? What are they are doing? So we looked at, for example, one of our studies looked at Facebook profiles, and we were interested in when people create their first Facebook profiles, here is an opportunity for them to do anything they want. It's difficult if you have a physical space for you to suddenly say, okay, I'm going to throw in a swimming pool. But with a Facebook profile, you can do anything. You can be anyone. And so we were looking to see, are people trying to create images of themselves that are ideal as they would like to be or as they really see themselves. And what we found was that people here are really trying to be seen as they see themselves. When we get people to view Facebook profiles and we look at their personality impressions, those impressions correspond much more closely to how the profile owner really sees himself than how they would like to be.
You talk about how people see themselves. How accurate are people's self-perceptions?
Well, that's a very good question. And people's self-perceptions are accurate for some things, but not for others. So if I wanted to know about you and I wanted to say, do you worry a lot about money? Are you an anxious person? Then the best person to ask about that would be you, because you're the one who has all those thoughts running around your head. Even other people may not see that you may be sitting there looking perfectly calm, but really these thoughts are running around your head, so I should ask you. If I wanted to know something else, if I wanted to know, for example, if you're stingy, then I shouldn't ask you. What I should do is I should ask your friends, because your friends are the ones who get stuck paying the extra 50 cents at the end of the meal when you say, well, I only had a water, I didn't have an iced tea or whatever it was, so I should pay less than everyone else. So different people are accurate for different things. But one of the crucial things is, even if you are wrong about yourself, it's very important for me to know how you see yourself. So let's say I was hiring somebody to work for my company. I probably don't really need to know how they see themselves. I need to know if they're reliable and if they're outgoing and if they have broad interests. That's good enough, regardless of how they see themselves. But if I was getting to know someone and wanting to become intimate with that person, it's really crucial to know how that person sees themselves, even if they're wrong. If somebody has this self-view of being, say, a victim, I'm always passed over for a promotion, no one gives me the opportunity, you know, everyone else goes and has fun and leaves me alone. You know, even if that's not true, even if those ideas of being a victim are not true, for me to truly know who that person is, I need to know that that's the way that person sees him or herself.
Sam Gosling is my guest. His new book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It's very interesting to read the book that intuitions often fail us, even in terms of the words that we use. For example, you found that as a predictor of the longevity of relationships, you can look at the number of positive and negative words that people use. Can you talk a little bit about that research?
Yeah. So this is one of those cases where you would think, well, it was looking at interactions between couples and saying, well, which words do people use when they're communicating? And it's easy to think, well, that these words are going to predict how well they will get on in the long term. You might expect the language they use to indicate some sort of deeper psychological processes going on. But really, without knowing the research, we wouldn't know whether it's positive words or negative words or neither or both that actually predict how long these relationships are going to last. And it turns out that it's just the use of positive words, not negative words, that predicts that.
So in other words, if people are using a lot of positive words, that's a good sign. But even if they use a lot of negative words, that doesn't have any impact.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, you can't really count that if you're having a conversation.
Right. So a lot of these things is very, very hard to keep track of. So for something like that, you really need specialized software to count the number of words. Yeah, these things, especially word use, people have very, very little idea of, even if they're thinking carefully about it and trying to focus on it.
Why do you think that we are drawn to snoop on people?
Well, I think really, as I said, people are the most important elements in our lives, and it's crucial that we know what they're like. We're deciding who to form alliances with, who to trust, who to employ, and I think we will search for information wherever we can.
But you found the medicine cabinet really is not a great... people are wasting their time checking out the ointments and pills that you have in the bathroom.
That's right. I mean, and the other areas are like medicine cabinets and refrigerators, which, those are the sort of the classic cases of where we look and think we can learn about people. And it is true that in some cases, some very extreme cases, something can be learned about people from looking at them. But in general, people have such similar things here that there really isn't much to distinguish one person from another. You can look in, say, a medicine cabinet. You might see, well, how organized or tidy it is, and see that the toothpaste tube has been impulsively squeezed from the middle, not carefully rolled up from the end. But beyond that, there's just not enough of a rich enough vocabulary in those places for people really to express differences.
But you are actually one of those exceptions, at least when it comes to your refrigerator.
Yeah, that's right. I had never realized this, because I'm generally a very, very messy person, but I had very long time been puzzled about my refrigerator, because unlike the rest of my place, which is pretty chaotic, my refrigerator's OCD. If you look in it, there's all the bottles of tonic water going in a straight line right next to, all the way to the back, right next to the soda waters, next to the Coke and the bitter lemon and the lemonade, and then the beers all in line. I mean, it's really an OCD refrigerator, and I had always been puzzled by it. And it wasn't until I met this architect that I mentioned, Chris Travis, that I really suddenly had this epiphany and realized what was going on. And as I mentioned, Chris Travis had said that so many of his clients are trying to recreate a feeling of a grandparent's home. And I remember coming back feeling very superior about this. Oh, isn't it interesting how all those people there are affected by their grandparents' home? How interesting of them to do that. And then when I looked inside my refrigerator, even though I'd had the refrigerator for many years, I had this flashback to when I was staying at my grandmother's with my brother, and we'd go out into the garden, and we'd go and run around the garden and play, and my grandmother would say, okay, well, when you get thirsty, just let yourselves in, and you can go to the drinks cabinet and have as much tonic water as you like. And we'd say, what do you mean as much? Yep, as much as you like. And it just seems so abundant that I've obviously gone and recreated my grandmother's cabinet in my own refrigerator.
I think a lot of people think that would be a great idea. Sam Gosling is my guest. His book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to Sam Gosling. He is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. His book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. So what's going on, Sam, with people who collect things? What's the need for that?
Collecting. A lot of animals collect, and I think really it is a vestige of essentially what animals do. You see a squirrel collecting nuts, and they've done research on squirrels where if they lesion an area of the brain, one area will stop them collecting. And if they lesion another area of the brain, they will never stop collecting, and they will behave very much like some of us do in hoarders. But there is a difference between people who hoard, that is, who can't throw anything away. And it should be borne in mind that all of us have small hoarding tendencies, but not all of us hoard so much that we can't even walk across the floor as some people do. So I think it's really this idea of people who enjoy order, they enjoy completion, and they enjoy this sense of control. And indeed, you find that people with collections do tend to be high on this the personality factor I mentioned earlier associated with this, the Robocop factor or conscientiousness. People tend to be high on that if they have a collection, whereas people who are just hoarders, they tend to be higher on neuroticism.
And hoarders there are a couple of different motivations that cause them to have these behaviors, right?
There are a number of different ones. I mean, in terms of collecting, some people just want this. They enjoy this sense of completion and it's this meeting this need for order, really.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Sam Gosling. His book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. So you have discovered that people who are at work and are allowed to sort of trick out their space the way that they want it are happier. They tend to stay longer and perform better.
Yeah.
How do you know that that's not a sort of chicken and the egg? How do you decide that they're happier because they're allowed to decorate?
I mean, you're right. It's very, very hard. Hard to do those experiments, and we don't really know. You're right.
But I guess it doesn't hurt for HR teams all over to let people do what they want.
It doesn't. But yeah, I mean, we know that people tend to be in those spaces where they can't decorate and they don't have control. More generally, they tend to be frustrated. And also, I mean, in terms of allowing people to get on with one another, it's really, really crucial that people have a right idea about what other people are like. And I think that's really what's driving people to put for example, personal photos up and so people know what they're like. Although, of course, there are great cultural differences. In some cultures, there's a much smaller amount of integration between home life and work life.
Of all the places in our homes that reveal things about us, do you think the bedroom is usually the number one spot?
Well, the bedroom is a good place because that reveals really what it is that you actually do. And so I like to look not only just at single spaces, but also look at comparisons between places. So looking at, say, the bedroom compared to the public spaces. Do you have all the highbrow learned books and so on out in the public spaces, but really the trashy novels in the bedroom? Because that shows that that's really where people are being themselves and engaging in these activities that aren't just for show. That's where people put the things that they care about often and can surround themselves with those. It's a special little sanctuary for many people.
It's become so common now for people of a certain level of means to have a decorator come in and sort of decide what they should have and where they should put it and how they should arrange it. Do people ultimately find that process stressful because it doesn't really allow them to reflect themselves?
Well, yes and no, but I think often we are trying to create a place that looks like some magazine or something we saw. So to the extent that we aren't able to really put up the things that allow us to be known, it is an impediment. But we don't typically select decorators randomly. We choose ones that we like because we feel they match our sense of aesthetic and so on. So I think, you know, they are often allowing us and giving us the means to do what we actually want to do. It's just we're unable to pull it off ourselves.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Suzanne in Carrollton. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. I have a question about your guest thoughts on the other end of the spectrum. I am in the process of purging everything from my house right now, trying to get it organized, and I'd love to know if he's done any research on that and what that means. And thanks. I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very interesting. And I must say, getting rid of stuff is very easy, and making these big changes in personality is something that we often want to do, but it's quite hard to do. I myself have tried to do this, and I go through these stages of where I do have something that's relatively neat for me, and then I manage to throw a lot of stuff out. I remember I did this for my own CD collection once. I thought, well, I'm going to change. I'm going to be the sorts of person who gets organized, and I went to IKEA and got all these little CD organizing trays, and I put all the CDs in it, and I labeled them, and they're all alphabetized. And I did have a beautifully organized CD collection, but it only lasted for a day because by the end of the week, I was back to being me and the person who gets the CD out and just puts it down and doesn't put it back in its case and so on. And so really, although you can make these sort of environmental superficial changes to your space, it's really a matter of which I had to do, is sort of like facing up to who you are. And that's why these spaces are so difficult to fake, because it's very difficult to actually live that different, live a different life, live the life where you're actually somebody who has that place for everything. So many times I have a document in my hand, and I think, I just wish there was a place for this, but I just don't have that place.
This is so often a source of conflict for parents and their children, mm-hmm. with the kids' bedrooms. And, you know, I've bought my 8-year-old 1,000 organizing things. I think we were behind each other in line at IKEA.
Uh-huh.
Is it just something that, I mean, is it not really possible to change someone's basic level of neatness?
There's some room for flex. I mean, we know that most of these personality traits that I was talking about have a very high level of heritability to them. But there is some room to flex, but you can only flex so far. And you can learn to engage in, you know, certain behaviors. But really, it's very, very hard to change the basic personality. Yeah, it's better to come to terms with it. And others, too, as well as ourselves.
We have a question from Megan in Tyler who says, regarding people who have generally messy or unorganized living spaces but have one or two areas that are very organized, I feel I do this because some areas allow me to be meticulous. Areas like the refrigerator where objects are categorized are those I like to be perfect, while I find other things impossible to organize. And she asks, what does this say about me?
Well, I think what's very interesting, this is one of these cases of looking at the different types of mess. So, for example, there is Eric Abramson, who is really the expert on mess. He says there are many, many different varieties of mess and many different varieties of neatness. And so you can look at, say, a mess that is two messes that may look superficially the same, but one of these is the mess of somebody who's messy and really doesn't care about it. They're happy with being messy. And the other is the mess of somebody who'd like to get organized. So you might see in that place unused organizational items. Maybe they have unused file folders, or they have file folders that haven't been used properly, and so on. And so what this suggests about Megan is that she falls into this latter category. She's somebody who is unable to really keep it together, just as I'm not able to keep it together on a day-to-day business in the whole place. But unlike many messy people, she is somebody who truly values organization and is able to take control in those small domains where she's able to pull it off. And that's different from somebody who just doesn't care about it.
Do you imagine, Sam, that research like this, as it continues, might be incorporated into the practice of people who are doing psychology in a clinical setting?
Part of many of the clinical diagnoses involve looking at people's spaces in terms of, because one of the areas of diagnosis is whether or not people are able to maintain ordinary life, including their living spaces. But I haven't done any research on people with disorders, so I don't know the degree to which those different disorders could be picked up in people's spaces.
So how can we use the kind of information that you have in your book to sort of be happier in the spaces that we have right now?
Well, I think that there's a number of ways that are important. One of the ways is in perceiving others, but in understanding our own spaces, it helps us to know how we are viewed. So people are coming in and forming impressions of us all the time, and it's really useful to know that even though some of these things they're getting right, they're also getting stuff wrong. So we learned, for example, that when people have these disorganized spaces like I do, people will come in and they will form impressions that of me, which correct impressions that I am somebody low on this Robocop factor and so on, but they will go beyond that evidence. They will go beyond that evidence to say that I'm actually low on this agreeableness dimension. And it turns out the messiness is not at all related to that, yet people will go beyond the evidence and form that impression. So it's very useful for me to be aware of how other people are using these and the wrong impressions they may be jumping to.
Why do you think that it would seem as if we, of course, we don't understand each other all that well, but it would seem as if we would have evolved by now to understand better and to not make these leaps, to assume that someone who's messy is disagreeable, for example?
I don't know why we're not evolved better. Yeah, well, we're not.
That's a question for the ages, I guess. Yeah. Let's speak next to Charlie in Willow Park. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, what a great program.
Thank you.
this dangerous Brit you've got in there, I need to tell him that the way we built all the modern fighter aircraft is doing exactly what you're doing by watching what the kids did in the simulator,
mm-hmm.
and then modeling everything after it. And I suspect we could really build great human factors interfaces for cars and telephones and cell phones if we did the same thing. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think that's a superb idea. And actually, it would be, some people, of course, in city planning have done that too, have looked and saying, well, which routes do people actually take? Let's look at those before we, build in the paths and so on. But what a great idea that would be also for designing houses. Let's see how people are operating and doing it. And essentially, that's what these people who are interested in client perspectives are trying to do. But I love the idea of behaviorally being a behavioral architect too.
What made you start to think that the way people conduct themselves within their physical spaces had so much to do with their personalities?
Well, I kind of got into it by accident. It wasn't my advisor in graduate school was very interested in what people do. He was very frustrated with the fact that most people in my field don't study what people do. They study what people say they do on personality questionnaires. And he said, we need to study behavior. And so I thought, well, it's very hard to study people. If I wanted to know what you did all day, I couldn't follow you around all day with a video camera. It would be, very difficult for you to behave naturally and so on. So it occurred to me that much of what we do, especially in the spaces where we spend a lot of time, much of what we do leaves traces in these spaces. And so it was only when I started looking at these spaces that I began to realize that was true. And then I began to notice these other things we're doing, too, in terms of making statements to others and so on.
Do you find yourself just insatiably curious now when you meet a new person that interests you? Do you want to know what their home looks like and what their office looks like?
Yeah, I do. And I've become a horrible bore because when I'm in the space, I'm constantly looking around and pointing out things and asking them why they have that there. Yeah.
And do you always snoop with permission?
Well, I think we're all snooping. I must say I've received a lot of invitations not to come to dinner recently.
Do you think people now sense that you're sort of always judging them based on their stuff, or do people who know you kind of understand that you separate those two things?
I think people generally think I'm judging them.
Have you changed anything about the way you sort of conduct yourself at home or at the office in terms of your things since you began this research?
I tried, but then I failed because, it's too difficult to really be fake because it involves such a concerted and persistent effort to really be different and also it's hard to see things differently, which is really the core of why it's difficult to fake.
Sam Gosling is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. His book is called Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Sam, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.